Geekscape.com. Can the White Race Survive? Part 10. Ancient and Modern Europe. Leaving Italy, which has received the greatest proportion of Negroid blood of any section of Europe, we can glance at Spain, Portugal, and Greece in particular, and at southeastern Europe in general. Spain and Portugal have received infiltrations of the black man's blood from different sources and at widely separated times in history. Perhaps the first were there during Paleolithic and Neolithic Europe, as the crania suggest. Beginning with the black slaves brought over by the ancient Carthaginians to work in their factories and mines in what is now Andalusia and Granada, the Negroes, or Mongols, never ceased to come into the Iberian Peninsula until a few hundred years ago. A considerable proportion was planted in the south by the Phoenicians, never to be removed. The later Roman occupancy of the country brought in many dark or black slaves, just as was the case on a much greater scale in the mother country. The greatest incoming of the Negroid element into Spain and southern Portugal resulted from the period of Moorish occupation. The Islamites were of impure blood themselves, while they carried with them large numbers of African slaves. The scholarly brilliance and fine architectural art that flourished during the Moorish occupation was ascribable in great measure, if not almost entirely, to the Jews who came in with the Moors in such great numbers and enjoyed complete tolerance and encouragement. The Moors and their black slaves left an indelible stamp of the brunette on a large part of the Spanish and Portuguese population. This dark blood is slowly filtering into the entire population of Spain, although there are still large sections of that usually likable, friendly people which are pure in their white ancestry. The Catalonians are notable examples of such, although of course a patriotic Catalonian will disclaim the charge of being a Spaniard. The Portuguese, seemingly not content with their previous inheritance of Negroid elements, committed the gruesome sin of introducing Negro slavery into the modern Western world and added distinctly to their Negroid element of blood by bringing their first West African captives into Portugal about the middle of the 15th century. How great became the importation and sale of Negro slaves into Portugal and Spain by the early Portuguese slave traders cannot be ascertained, but as it was nearly 100 years from the beginnings of the traffic until the great stream of slave ships was diverted across the Atlantic to the new lands of the Americas, the number deposited in Europe must have been considerable. As Portugal principally, and Spain, as a slow second, took most of these black slaves, few found sale in other countries of Europe. The Portuguese show, in portions, very definite traces of this more recent inflow of Negro blood. Although the pure Negro long since was blended with white blood, there are some descendants today of that fusion who have unmistakable Negro features. A striking specimen of such is illustrated in Figure 3, Plate 4, facing page 134 in Dixon's Racial History of Man. There is less pro rata purity of white among the Portuguese than among the Spanish. It would be interesting to make a careful comparison on a large scale between the descendants of an older and purer generation of Portuguese as found among the white Portuguese population of Brazil and the modern Portuguese in the mother country. I believe, from insufficient personal observation, that a larger percentage of nearly pure whites exist in Brazil, Although the latter country has opened the door wide to a quick submergence of the white element there. Greece and the nearby lands to the north and east, to Constantinople and up the west coast regions of the Black Sea through Romania, have received a steady dribble of Negroid tincture from very ancient times. This dribble has always remained a dribble, seldom if ever halted, but slowly and very certainly destroying the fine old ethnic strain of wonderful people who filled some of the brightest pages of history. The glories of the classical Greek age have been sung by all the world's poets from Homer to our own time. Our modern civilization, with its great arts and sciences, owes a debt to the old Greek race, which mathematicians could never compute. Hardy whites they were, who in the misty dawn of prehistoric times moved out of the east from that mother nest of the whites about the Caspian section into Europe and gravitated into the fingers of land reaching into the inland sea. Like our own white ancestors of the North European peoples, these roaming hardened nomads carried little with them from the homeland of their ancestors. Very likely, they wandered away across the vast stretches of southern Russia in small clans, even in family groups. These groups increased, left some of their numbers on the way. The others, following that irresistible pioneering instinct that has carried the white man as conqueror to the ends of the earth, moved on into the west. Here they split up, in middle Europe, some wandering on up the valleys of the Dnieper, Bug, Dniester, and Danube, to reach and people northern and central Europe. To these we shall refer a little later. Other parcels of the same stock turned their faces southwards by the west of the Black Sea until they reached the balmy shores of the sea in the midst of the earth. There were very early comers into the neighbourhood of Greece who had already attained to large tribal proportions when the newcomers arrived. In places, these later arrivals fought and conquered the first, but they were all essentially of the same stock. Melting into a fairly homogeneous whole, these peoples developed the culture that has left its trail in stone and marble and in written scientific, poetical, and philosophical works for the delight and edification of a grateful world. We have seen how those much earlier pioneers from the white man's Caspian cradle moved southwards into fertile valleys where they came into contact with and enslaved the Negro natives of the southern shores of Asia and of northeast Africa. Those groups who moved with their few belongings into the colder lands of Europe neither carried black slaves with them, nor found autochthonous Negro peoples to conquer and mix with in the lands where they went, with a single exception mentioned further on in connection with Poland. While their cousins, the Akkadians and Egyptians, early came into touch with the Negro, the peoples who found homes in Europe knew nothing during early times of the existence of a black-skinned being. But this ignorance of the black man's existence was not to continue for those who reached and prospered on the shores of the Mediterranean. Civilization, with its trading ships and warring armies, came in the natural course of time with blessings and curses. As we have pointed out as a historical record, black slaves were much desired by the early Greeks. As with Rome, so with Rome's predecessors and preceptors in Greece, conquering armies brought back great numbers of slaves. When these conquerors began to reach out into southern Asiatic lands during the last part of the second millennium and on into the first millennium BC, the peoples in these regions had already become much mongrelized, and the slaves brought back from there bore their mongrel blood to gradually dribble into the masses of the Greek populace. Added to these were the pure black slaves of whom we read in the ancient annals. This incoming taint of the Negroid, during the course of 1,000 years, so enfeebled the vitality of intellect and high spirit of the Greeks in the peninsular districts that they were unable to make effective common resistance to the Romans in the 2nd century BC. The Macedonians, who up to this time had not received the same unfortunate inheritance as had the inhabitants in the centre of the older civilization, were a stronger foe for the Roman legions. But the indomitable, unconquering spirit of Thermopylae and Marathon, although only a relatively short period of history intervened, had departed forever. No longer were there great poets to sing of their golden-haired Xanthos heroines and fair heroes, for neither the genius of the poet nor the fair warriors existed any more. The glory that had been Greece, like its contemporary on the Indus and the Ganges, and like its predecessors of the Euphrates, Tigris, and Nile valleys, was wilted before its silent, terrible conqueror, the conqueror that wins without planning, organization, or fighting, and wins inexorably and permanently. Why is it that intelligent people, great historians and scholars, cast about so vainly to explain the decadence of greatness in the Greek and Italian peoples, to say nothing of those of the places where other ancient glory flowered and faded? In every single case, the explanation is written with glaring characters in the changed physiognomy and colour of the peoples. They are no longer the same pure white peoples. They are as vastly different from their ancient ancestors as if the latter had never existed, for the overpowering influence of their Negro ancestry has choked out every semblance of the greatness that surely would still be theirs were they pure in their white ancestry. From the time the cities of Greece fell under the sway of Rome until the coming of the waves of Slavs, there was little change, one way or the other, in the ethnic constitution of the Greeks. The levelling ethnic process was following its slow course. It is possible that at the time the first Slavs reached Greece, the people were darker than they are today. The Slavic strain, implanted into their population, which was considerable, must have lightened the general complexion. The Albanians brought in a stock of doubtful nature, perhaps not much different from the average Greek mongrel, for the Albanians had been heirs to much seepage of blood from the contiguous northern territories from the south during the many centuries mongrelization had been going on in the seacoast cities and states. The subjugation in 1453 of Constantinople by the Osman Turks brought Greece under the cruel heel of the mongrel Turk. How the Turks affected the ethnic features of the Greeks of Greece proper is not clear, but it is almost certain that the peoples of Greek extraction on the mainland of Asia were not favourably changed, but if any change occurred, it was for the worse. The Turks, in spite of the seeming anti-slavery teaching of the Quran, have always been extensive slavers. Their Egyptian vassals were among the most heartless slave gatherers the pitifully helpless Negroes of Africa ever suffered from. Motley hordes of black slaves were exacted as tribute from Nubia and neighbouring regions, and where the tribute in human flesh was not forthcoming peacefully, armed forces were sent to hunt them out with unspeakable brutality. This practice continued until past the middle of the 19th century. These black slaves were distributed by way of the slave marts of Turkey into Asia and into Constantinople. It is not probable that many of them ever reached Greece except as servants of Turkish officialdom. It is certain that this Negro stream of slaves was absorbed into the masses of the populations of Asiatic Turkey, and to some extent into the populations of Turkish possessions in the Balkans. A relatively small number became emasculated servants or eunuchs. There is no reason to believe there were not as many female black slaves as male. The Turks themselves, when they appeared from their distant Asiatic habitat, were not without some Negroid taint. They had acquired this during the last 2,000 years or so, while their ancestors had wandered about the edges of China, where the Siberian populations were slowly changing their ethnic makeup from pure white to a tainted type. This accounts for the wanton cruelty of the Turk, for there is no more vicious people on earth than that type, classed as of the white race, but tainted to a slight degree with blood of the black. It should no longer be a strange fact that American students of immigration problems have lumped the peoples of Balkan countries with undesirable peoples. If one will take maps of former Turkish dominions in southeastern Europe, it will quickly be seen that the countries from which our immigration authorities have decided to restrain immigrants to the utmost are those into which Turkey poured her tainted strains during 500 years. This does not mean that all communities in the Balkans have been mongrelized by the Turks, but this scourging clan of ruthless rulers certainly mongrelized sections that were pure white at their coming and added to the taint already existing in the more southern and eastern sections. The peoples within the present bounds of northern and western Yugoslavia were never completely subdued in spirit by the Turks and retained comparative purity, while Albania, Bulgaria, Rumelia, and portions of Romania suffered a worse fate. Outside of the portions of southern and southeastern Europe specifically mentioned in this podcast, Europe is inhabited in its entirety by the white race in almost original purity. In eastern and southeastern Russia, there is a late Mongolian element in more or less predominance with its mongrel taint of blood. In portions of the Polish population, there is a strange indication of some Negroid blood, and from some very ancient source, the Lapps must have received a modicum of Negroid, which, combined with the sterile environment under which these people have always lived, has made of them a backward type. How the isolated spot of Negroid in Poland came about is inexplicable by historical records. Perhaps a future work by scientists investigating among prehistoric burial grounds will find more definite traces of the Neolithic tracks of the proto-Negro, mentioned scantily by Dixon as having gone up the sea coasts from the Iberian Peninsula to as far as the Baltic lands and is traceable there in some numbers in very ancient times. Perhaps the white ancestor race of the Basques came at a very early time into southwestern Europe and split off a northern remnant of indigenous Negroes who wandered slowly ahead of the whites until they reached the Baltic coasts and were there finally hemmed in and subjugated by the first comers in the northern or western flow of whites. Assuming that the first whites to reach that section came either from the south or the east. The resultant mixture was perhaps slowly segregated into the localities where we find it today. This dark type of the pole is to this day more or less shunned by the neighbouring pure white peoples, which doubtless is the survival of a sentiment that has always prevailed and has been the means of preventing a more complete absorption into the Baltic population. There is a tendency among the Nordicists to consider blonde hair and blue eyes as the criterion for the greatest purity of white blood. There can be no question but that peoples among whom the characteristic of blondness prevails are to be counted among the purest whites. Yet there are often instances of blonde hair and blue or grey eyes among octoroons and quadroons. We must always consider the colour and nature of the skin as first of importance in judging racial purity, and added to these faithful indications, there are other features of less certain implications, as the nose, lips, eyes, and cephalic index. I believe that science will finally discover the colour of the hair and even of the eyes are, during the course of many generations, changed by a consistent diet on certain foods. These two items of human physical makeup can be affected in this way, but the colour of the skin and other physical features of a more permanent nature mentioned earlier can never be changed except by ethnic mixture. There are great blocks of brunette peoples in Europe who give every indication of being as pure whites as do the Scandinavians and North Germans. These indications are invariably in the colour of the skin and in intellectual capacity. The negroid brunette carries the ineradicable evidence of his dark ancestry in a combination of features. Skin colour, colour and texture of hair, nose, lips, intellectual power. Among the white-skinned intellectual peoples of Central and Northern Europe and their kin, transported across the seas, we find the great armies of scholars, statesmen, scientists, technicians, the builders of civilization, with blondes and brunettes equally represented. The dark-haired, brown-eyed Frenchman, Swiss, South German, Scotchman, or Northern and Eastern Irishman is nonetheless of the progressive intellectual white race because of the colour of his hair and eyes. In closing this discussion of Europe, I wish to point out and emphasise the reason why there are still white people in this world to build our modern civilization, which has already so greatly transcended all ancient cultures. And I must, with greater emphasis, point out that if this last great homeland of the white race and civilization is not saved from Mongolization, the future will see this globe of ours devoid of all civilization. Earlier in this podcast, I suggested the probable route taken by the first white emigrants as they slowly trekked towards the setting sun from the Caspian cradleland of the white race. If those very earliest white people of the Caspian region had any knowledge of the Negro, the emigrants who broke away as nomadic bands into the steppes and forests of Russia were too poor to afford the luxury of this menial helper, and therefore, besides their horses and cattle, they took no living beings except the members of their families. Leaving the parent stock long before mongrelization had set in, the pioneers carried their racial purity with them. In the vast regions where they penetrated further and further until the Western Seas stopped them, they found no inhabitants ahead of them, unless such was the case with the very first of all, the ancestors of the Basques, who must have found Negroes in southwestern Europe and absorbed a small tinge of their blood, as before mentioned. The great body of Aryan-speaking groups that came into Europe at later periods found only virgin forests and plains to subdue. These hardy whites built their homes and castles and did all their own work or knew the luxury of slave labour only by capturing members of other tribes equally as white as they were and therefore bearing no danger of ethnic corruption. Far removed from lands largely or completely inhabited by the Negroes, they never knew for thousands of years that other than whites lived on earth. For this very good reason, the principal portions of Europe, shut off by mountain barriers and impassable seas, preserved a pure storehouse of the white race, while other branches of the same stock were building their brilliant cultures, indulging in the luxury of black slave labour, and slowly sinking into the slough of mongrelization and extinction. Thus, at the beginning of the 16th century, we find the only pure white people on earth were in Europe. By their very energy and initiative, they reached out during a few centuries to encompass the whole globe with their colonies, commerce, and influence. This very process, commendable as it is, will eventually prove the ruin of this last great stand of the whites if they do not accept timely warning. With each day developing greater ease of transportation from the farthest portions of earth, and with all the attractions of the white man's civilization and industry to draw the negroid mongrels, Europe is certain to receive ever-increasing accretions of the mongrel strain if stringent measures are not adopted to cut them off. This matter will be discussed more extensively in the last podcast.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.